The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, and I'd like to welcome you all to the second day of the second annual symposium on emerging issues in national and international security. And today we are very lucky to have C-SPAN coverage for these two panels, so for the first panel and the second panel of the morning. And so we'd like to thank them for coming out. Just a small handful of administrative remarks. Actually, only one or two now that I think about it. Any members of the press who are here or who want to talk to any of the speakers after any of the panels today will need to do so in room 600. We'll set that room aside for press inquiries, press interviews immediately after the panelists finish speaking. This will be an hour and 15-minute panel with the possibility of extension to hour and a half, depending on how the questions go, followed by a 15-minute break. That being said, I want to welcome you all here, and I hope you enjoy the second day. I'll introduce Judge William Young. He is a federal judge from Boston. He is going to be the moderator of the first panel. Thank you, and have a good day. Well, good morning. Welcome to a panel on the international adjudication of terror. As Kelly said, my name is Bill Young. I'm a trial judge, a United States trial judge. I've been a trial judge for well around 29 years now. Now, I say that only to point out that in all those 29 years, I have had only two cases that remotely fit within the definition that this panel has been given. So I am only the moderator, and when we get to questions, and we're going to leave plenty of time for questions, and we most solicit your questions, I'm happy to try and answer any questions, but I know that most of them will be directed to our panelists, because there has been assembled for you this morning a truly distinguished panel. And I'll introduce them from my far right, working in. At my far right is the Honorable Aoife Sidhui. Judge Sidhui is a judge of the court in Indonesia. She is an expert, and she and I have been talking. She is an expert in intellectual property. She is an expert in a variety of civil matters, human rights cases, but also she has been designated by the Indonesian Supreme Court as one of the judges on the terrorism cases that eventuated out of the bombings in Bali. She, in presiding over those cases, has used the most advanced technological means to receive the presentation of evidence, and she truly is an expert in the area. Next to her, in the middle of our panel, is Dr. Abdullah Ansari. Dr. Ansari has his BA in Legal Studies from King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, his LLM from Harvard, and his Doctor of Juridical Science from the University of Virginia. Dr. Ansari is a senior foreign law specialist at the Library of Congress right now, and his particular expertise, so helpful to us here this morning, is the careful, reflective consideration of how different societies have set up and handled terrorism and terrorism-related cases. Next to me here is the Honorable Mr. Justice Ronnie Weatherup. Justice Weatherup was called to the Bar of Northern Ireland in 1971. He's an expert, was and is an expert in administrative law. He has been senior counsel to the Attorney General and was appointed Justice of the High Court, Judge of the High Court of Justice in Northern Ireland in 2001. Justice Weatherup's practice is in many ways akin to my own. He sits primarily civil, but unlike me and unlike most judges, trial judges in the United States, he has routinely, if routine is once, twice a year, he has been called to preside over genuine terrorist cases and brings to us a great deal of experience. That's the panel. I'm simply going to call them up one by one, keep time. The order that we're going to proceed is first Dr. Ansari to give us an overview, then Justice Weatherup, and then Judge Sadoui, and then your questions. Would you please welcome Dr. Abdullah Ansari. Dr. Ansari?
Thank you, Judge Young. I'm really honored to be a member of this distinguished panel. And I hope that my talking points today will serve as an introductory to their expertise. To begin with, let me say that we all agree that the primary duty of any national state is the maintenance of its internal and external security. Governments invoke national security as the rationale for taking unlimited measures against any threat. Governments or states claim the right to limit certain individual freedoms in defending itself and to protect the security. And also, in seeking of doing that, they pass many laws, special measures, and amend their laws to make it adequate to meet these challenges. Well, in response to the problem of terrorism, for example, some governments have proposed the idea of establishing special criminal courts. These courts come with a special structure, such as no jury, the involvement of military judges, also with jurisdiction limited to specific category of offenses, with special trial and pre-trial procedure, such as expanded powers of arrest, detention, and internment, extensive power of entry, search and seizure, waiving the right of silence, the use of aggressive interrogation methods, changing in the rule of that govern the admissibility of confession, and the shift in burden of proof. These special measures afford departure from the state's regular criminal justice system. The challenge is how to deal effectively with terrorism or national security crimes without sacrificing either the rule of law or the right to a fair trial. We are all in agreement that special powers may help in reduce violence and actually remove from society those individuals who perpetrated such an act. But also, the special measures have an impact on civil rights and promoted questions regarding the availability of fair trial. National security courts, usually known as a system of non-military special courts whose jurisdiction is limited to specific offenses, mostly constituting threats against state security. Recent history afforded several examples of these courts, like the French State Security Courts established in 1963 and abolished in 1981. Also, the recent abolished Turkish State Security Court established or re-established in 1984. Among those still in operation are the Special Aziz Court of France, established in 1986. Also, the so-called Diplock Court in Northern Ireland, established in 1972, and the Special Criminal Court in Republic of Ireland, established in 1972. National security system were introduced usually following the violence events that constituted a direct challenge to the nation's stability. But there is a number of arguments that have been deployed to justify the presence of these special courts. Take the 1963 French State Security Court as an example. It has been actually created to combat subversive activity, largely resulted as the terrorist activity in Algeria, resulting from the involvement of the government in Algeria. But the stated reason for establishing such special court was that cases could be adequately dealt with in time of peace and judged quickly with the least fuzz possible. The Special Aziz Court in France that still exists to the present day created as an alternative to the difficulties to protect jurors against possible intimidation from those being judged, as well as in some cases there was a certain mistrust of jurors, especially when it comes to national security secrets. The Turkish State Security Court was established to deal with, as they call it, the new phenomenon of terrorism, and they said that we should have new methods to investigate and special measures to enforce and special jurisdiction courts to prosecute them. The Diplock Court has been established to deal with the problem of witnesses and jurors' intimidation, and also because of the real danger of what they call it perverse verdict from pious jurors. The Constitution of the Republic of Ireland permit the government to establish special courts. If the government feels that the ordinary criminal justice system inadequate to secure the effective administration of justice and the preservation of public peace. And this is what exactly they did when after the violence in Northern Ireland. Throughout the period of their existence, national security courts have been subject of almost continuous concern resulting from the adoption of extraordinary powers. Take an example. For example, the structure of courts has involved the use of military judges in French State Security Court. There was two military judges serving as assessors to the president judge who was a civilian. Also in Turkish Criminal Court, there was a military judge serving in the panel of three judges. Two of them are civilians. The Irish Special Criminal Court in 1939 to 1946 and from 1961 to 1962 also actually was designed by military officers, and all the procedures at that time were in secret. The military judges' lack of independence from the administrative authority, the limitation on their terms of office as national security judges, and their vulnerability to military discipline raised serious questions regarding their independence and impartiality, and successfully has been challenged by the European Court of Human Rights. I'm going to skip the talk about the Diplock Court and the use of one judge panel. I'm sure that Judge Weatherup will comment on that. And I will go to talk about the special procedure that also states adopt to combat terrorism for cases within the jurisdiction of the National Security Courts. I will give an example of the Turkish military, state security court that has been recently abolished. It has been created, as I told you, in 1984, or reestablished in 1984. The law that governed the system basically offered few civil, few protections of defendant rights. The law itself extended police custody periods, sometime up to 30 days. And the ability to prevent immediate case to the ability to prevent also the defendant from having access to lawyer for that period. You have also when the Turkish decided to reform their criminal justice system in 1992, they made a massive reform for their criminal penal code and criminal procedure code. But they enacted Article 31 of this reform. Article 31 basically excluded all these reforms from applying to any suspect under the jurisdiction of the Turkish criminal court. Let's have the special Aziz court also as an example. The National Security Court or the special state security court were authorized to extend the period of police custody for up to 10 days and sometime up to 15 days, and that will also affect the right to legal advice for the suspect. Also, during such period of custody, suspect did not have the right to call relatives to inform them of their arrest. The special Aziz court that exists up to now also have their kind of special procedure. Police search houses, search looking for evidence, no longer require the permission of the person concerned, and search may be done at night. That's different from the ordinary criminal procedure in France. Basically, I'm going to end up by saying that Western societies are living today under threat of terrorism and must deal with this evil within the framework of democratic principles and the rule of law. In the struggle against terrorism and offenses against the security of the state, individual democratic nations must strike a proper balance between national security and freedom, because both values are compelling interests for the state. Thank you, and I'm looking forward for your questions.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Justice Ronnie Wetherup.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure for me to be here, a privilege indeed, to be in such distinguished company. We are now emerging from that period of civil conflict, and therefore it may be that these special measures are being repealed, or they may be assimilated into the general law, as there is a new form of terrorism which is now engaged in the international front. What I propose to do is very briefly outline to you some of the measures which our legal system adopted in response to the threat which emerged some 30 years ago. As a preliminary matter, I should say that it is not possible to translate one conflict situation into any other conflict situation. Each has its own particular ingredients, and each may require its own measures in order to address the problems that have arisen. In Northern Ireland, I think it's important to recognize the context in which the conflict arose. It was, in effect, a dispute between competing paramilitary organizations who were in conflict with each other and with the forces of the state through the local police and the National Army. One generally thinks, I think, outside Northern Ireland of the conflict as being one of the IRA against the government. It wasn't as simple as that. There were opposing paramilitary organisations which set out to take measures against the IRA or those whom they perceived to be supporters of the IRA. And that organisation too was in conflict with the government because it thought that measures were being taken to make concessions to the opposing organisation. So there's a triangle of interests here which were all in conflict with each other, and measures had to be taken in order to address that very serious breakdown in civil society that emerged. This is what the academics call a conflicted democracy. The context of the dispute, therefore, is where there are issues that arise in what is essentially a democratic state, but within the state there are elements which may not recognise it as being democratic or which may contest its democratic validity. But that is a different context to some other terrorist situations, and of course it is quite different to the international threat which is now prevalent and which affects the United States. That threat is of a different character. It involves a different religious aspect, different cultural background, and certainly to that which prevails throughout most of the states in Europe and America, and will no doubt require its own measures in order to address the particular problems that arise. Now, having said that about the background, it's also necessary to say something, I think, about the character of the terrorist attack that are made, because while they're largely indiscriminate in that they're directed towards members of the public in an indiscriminate way, which arises from bombings and so forth, they are also directed in this instance in Northern Ireland against the state, against the institutions of the state, and against the judiciary. And therefore, the judges themselves who are adjudicating upon those who perpetrate these actions themselves become the targets of the terrorists. And in that setting, it's particularly important to recognise a number of fundamental constitutional principles which I hope we have adhered to in addressing the issues that arise out of such conflict. The first is that the judiciary in your system and in our system is independent, and it is independent both of the government and of any other challenge to the application of the rule of law, and that is what terrorist activity is directed at, itself making that challenge to the rule of law. And of course the judges are ever alert to any appearance that their independence might be undermined, whether it is by government ministers or whether it is by terrorist activity. And a further principle which I should emphasise is that the government itself and its agencies are themselves subject to the rule of law, and that any citizen who comes before the courts in relation to any unlawful action that has been taken by the state against that citizen or any agent of the state is entitled to equal access before the courts in order to obtain redress from the courts, and that is according to the law itself. And therefore every citizen who appears before the courts must be treated equally. And that applies to those who have committed criminal offences, and that applies to those who are terrorists. That applies to those who have attacked the judicial system, and that applies to those who have attacked the judges themselves. We as judges, as Judge Young has said, are primarily judges in civil matters, where we also have to undertake criminal matters. But in the civil field, of course, the troubles, as they're called in Northern Ireland, have generated a lot of civil proceedings. There are actions against the police, there are actions against government institutions, against the prison service, and we have to make determinations in those civil proceedings against the rights of prisoners, the rights of those detained and arrested persons, the rights of those charged, both in a civil case and in a criminal case. We must adjudicate fairly upon those proceedings, even if those who are bringing the proceedings, as has often been the case, are and have been convicted of or are sympathetic to or supportive of the terrorist organisations that appear before you. The terrorist organisations, through their political wings, have appeared before us in relation to challenges that they make to various matters. And we, in turn, must treat those equally as we treat all other applications. To do otherwise, of course, is to undermine our system. Now, I want to say something very briefly about the matters that have been introduced in Northern Ireland to deal with the special procedures. First of all, I want to say something about three measures that have been introduced in relation to trial procedures. The first is in relation to mode of trial. Now, as Dr. Asari has mentioned, they have introduced in Northern Ireland in 1972 judge-alone trials in respect of terrorist offences. These are known as scheduled offences, and a list is drawn in a schedule to legislation of the types of offences that terrorist organisations would generally commit. All of those scheduled offences, therefore, go before a judge-alone trial. That is known as a Diplock trial because Lord Diplock was the chairman of the commission that sat to recommend the procedures that were required in 1972. The judge sits alone. He must write his decision when he has concluded the case, and there is an automatic right of appeal to the Court of Appeal. If you want to see any of those decisions, you look at them on the website. It's www.courtsni.gov.uk. Go to judgments and you will find the decisions that have been written in relation to the terrorist trial. The Diplock courts remain in operation in Northern Ireland today, and they have of course not been without their critics. The Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission has called for the restoration of trial by jury in all cases. They do so and recognise that there are measures that might be introduced in relation to the protection of juries, and they recommend that those measures be introduced in place of trial by a judge alone. There is an independent body set up to review the operation of the Diplock courts. It, in its 2005 review, concluded that the security situation in Northern Ireland was not such that return to jury trial could be recommended. However, the government has stated that it will replace the judge-alone trials next year in 2007. I want to put the matter in perspective for you. The figures I have are for 2004, the last I could find. In 2004, there were 740 scheduled offences charged against defendants. 111 offences remained for trial by judge alone. There is a system of certifying out if the offences are considered not to be related to the troubles. 111 offences remain. This involves 77 defendants. 27 of them pleaded guilty when they came on for trial. That left 50 who were pleading not guilty, of whom 23 were acquitted. The overall percentages there are similar to those which apply to trial by jury. So you see the scale is very much reduced, and compared to the height of the troubles in the 70s and 80s in Northern Ireland, that is relatively small proceedings in relation to terrorist trials. Legislation has been introduced in England and Wales and in Northern Ireland recently which provides for trial by judge alone in the case of jury tampering, and these provisions, which have not yet been commenced, are likely to be brought into effect, so that while the jury, Diplock trials are likely to be wound up very shortly, it would seem that what will replace them will be a system whereby the judge himself can determine whether there has been jury tampering, and he is then entitled to proceed by a judge alone. The second matter I want to say something about is admissibility of confessions. This was a further matter that was adjusted in 1972. The general law at that time provided for admissibility of confessions to exclude confessions obtained by oppression or threat or inducement. The 1972 Commission changed the threshold in relation to the admission of confessions. It provided that they would be rendered inadmissible if induced by torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or violence or threat of violence. This was to adopt the wording of Article 3 of the European Convention. The domestic requirement, as you will note, was more strict than the European requirement. This measure has now been repealed, and there is a common standard for all criminal trials, even when they're being conducted in the Diplock system, in relation to admissibility of confessions. A third matter where there was an alteration was proof of possession of firearms or explosives. There was a difficulty in relation to firearms explosives being found on premises or in vehicles where more than one person was present and each denied knowledge of the items that were recovered. It's often not possible to prove who had possession and therefore all were acquitted. You may have a similar problem yourselves in relation to your legal system. A provision was introduced then to the effect that where firearms or explosives were found on premises, then those present were deemed to have knowledge of it. But they could then raise evidence that they had no knowledge. And if they did that by what was called an evidential burden, which simply means that you raise some evidence and it requires the defendant in that case to offer some explanation, that's the object of the exercise, then the burden remains on the prosecution to prove knowledge. It doesn't change the burden of proof and is therefore compliant with the European Convention requirements in relation to the presumption of innocence. But it was a measure which required a defendant in that situation to offer an explanation and therefore satisfy the evidential burden. There were other matters then. Those were trial measures, and I should say that that measure in relation to proof has been absorbed into the general law in the sense that other offences of a non-terrorist nature involving possession, such as drugs offences, now require or involve similar provisions. Now, I was going to say something in relation to the measures that were introduced in relation to additional powers of arrest and detention, and I'll just say in relation to one of those matters concerning offences that were introduced to deal specifically with terrorism in conclusion. Offences have been created under our terrorist legislation whereby possession of an article for terrorist purposes and the collection of information for terrorist purposes that is likely to be useful for terrorists are contrary to the legislation. And these are the offences of which an Abbas Boutrab was convicted in Northern Ireland in 2005. He was the first Islamic terrorist tried in the United Kingdom. He was tried by a judge alone and convicted of the offences. The offence of possession of an article for terrorist purposes provides that a person commits an offence, I read the wording here, if he possesses an article in circumstances which give rise to a reasonable suspicion that his possession is for a terrorist purpose. That's the offence charged. Terrorist manuals were found in his flat and a dismantled item of electrical equipment was found there. Some of the components of the electrical equipment were missing. They happened to be the same components which were described in the literature as being an element that could be used in the construction of an improvised explosive device which it was suggested could be detonated on an aircraft. In that case, the proof of possession provision applied so that he was deemed to have knowledge and control of the items found in his possession in the event he admitted possession and control, but he claimed that he had an innocent purpose, namely a simple curiosity in relation to the literature that was found. In relation to the electrical components, he had found them in the street and had decided to detain them. The legislation places a burden on the prosecution in that case to prove the offence beyond reasonable doubt, in other words, to prove non-terrorist purpose. And the debate was, what was the character of this offence that had been introduced? The prosecution in the case said that their task was to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he had the items in his possession in circumstances which gave rise to a reasonable suspicion of a terrorist purpose. In other words, they did not contend that they had to prove terrorist purpose, merely reasonable suspicion of terrorist purpose. I was the judge who tried this case. I did not accept that argument and required the prosecution to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he had that his possession was for a terrorist purpose, not really that that it gave rise to a reasonable suspicion of a terrorist purpose. That's the standard I set, but I was satisfied and convicted him. You can read that judgment on the website if you wish, and you'll see the detail of the argument. Ladies and gentlemen, I end by referring to the present phase of the Northern Ireland story as what has been described as transitional justice. We are moving from conflict into peace, and the organisations which were involved in that conflict are moving now towards political engagement rather than violent engagement. The rule of law must apply throughout, as I've said, and all who seek access to it must be treated equally. And we now seek, having applied the rule of law during a period of war, we now seek to apply it in the transition from war to peace and in the conflict of the aftermath equally to all who appear before our courts. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. And now Judge Sadoui.
Thank you, Judge Yanam. Hello, good morning. I'm Eva Sadoui. I come from Indonesia. I'm very happy to meet you here. I would like to speak my experiences to handle or to adjudicate terrorism cases in my country. Unfortunately, my English is not so good, so on question and answer, I will assisted by my translator, Mr. Joe Siagian. Special thanks also to Kelly McClanahan for his attention for gender issues. The last 5 years, the safety of Southeast Asia is attacked by the issues of the terrorism, such as terrorism in Philippines, Thailand and Indonesia. I also assisted by PowerPoint to make me easier explain to you. This is Bali Island map. Indonesia is one Asian country that directly experiences big scale attacks and tragedy known as Bali Blast that happened in 12 October 2002 in the heart of Kuta Bali that killed 202 people, consists of 29 countries and injure 100 people, also damage many buildings, electricity, vehicle and another public facility. Bali Blast is really shocking the world, especially in the Balinese. They are very angry because the terrorism has refined a ruin that peaceful life. Virtually, most of suspects has been arrested. When the moment of the Bali Blast happened, Indonesia did not have the regulation of the anti-terrorism regulation. We only have the written general criminal or they only said about the murder, the torture to death and another general criminal. So the problem is the terrorist suspect will give less significant if we use the general crime because that's only about murder, torture to death, and another general criminal. So we know that the terrorism activities characteristics is different from the other conventional crime. And so far, there is no international guideline to determine what is the terrorism crime. However, Indonesia has been successful in formulating the Terrorism Act on the National Act. This is the picture of the suspect of the Bali bomb blast, Imam Samudra. He owns the characteristics of terrorists. He's young, clever, have the strong belief, and very militant. So after a week after the Bali bombing, Indonesia issued an emergency rule to handle or overcome a national problem. That the emergency rule is we call PERPU. The PERPU is the temporary act to be regulated emergency and very urgent situation in case the absence of law is made by the government, and the government must filing this act to be to parliament on the next session to be discussed. If the parliament agree, that act will be the permanent act, but if not, the act will be cancelled. And the virtually the purpose of the Bali blast is agreed by the parliament, and then after that, that purpose is become to be Indonesian Anti-Terrorism Act, number 15, 2002. The question is the Indonesia Anti-Terrorism Act has the same parameter and the qualification as the Terrorism Act that apply in other countries? Because I saw that some definition of terrorism in many countries determine terrorism depend on its country interest. My government or my country is serious to combating of the terrorism. Which Rob mentioned, we also have the changing of the criminal system. For example, for the evidence, we use for the first time, we recognize the electronic evidence, like SMS, everything about electronic evidence. Also, we recognize the there is no bank secrecy for the terrorism case. As long the bank secrecy is asked by the authorized party, like a police or the prosecutor. The other progress is we have the limitation of seizure. On the general criminal, we just allow the seizure for one time 20 hours. But for terrorism case, we allow 7 for 24 hours. And the Terrorism Act also mentioned about the witness protection and law enforcer protection. When examining the terrorism case, I also did the video conference. This is the new one in Indonesia. This is the first one in Indonesia. We have the video conference to examine the witness, because the witness is in Malaysia and they are on the jail. So some of the at that time some debit from the lawyer of the suspect is big debit in country, because there are objection of the what we call the mechanism, how to be get the witness, the evidence from the witness in the remote place. So as and then the Supreme Court allow to the Chamber of Judge to examine the witness on the remote place by send the one of Chamber Judge and one of the prosecutor to the remote place in Malaysia. According to the Indonesian Terrorism Act, we have formulate two types of what is the terrorism on the material formulation and on the formal formulation. We can see on the Article 6 and Article 7, the scene from two of this article at glance, both of the article is look like, but Article 6 uses a material formulation because it focuses on the consequence of the action when the wording causing, and if we analyze, we can get the causes of terror condition. Or fear to massive people because it's a massive victim by taking freedom or killing and taking other people's properties, or causes destruction or ruin to strategically vital object or environment or public facilities or international facilities. We have the obstacle to prove how to prove the causing violence or threatening to force the cause terror situation or fear to others massively. What are the criteria for terror situation and massive? This element is very broad, that is very difficult for Chamber of Judges to determine that criteria. In the terrorist case, we set on 3 and 5 on the chamber, we don't have jury, and this is helping a person in terrorist act. It gives 3 and maximum 5 years punishment. The planner and the motivator give the same punishment, and the limitation of punishment is. It needs the discretion for judge to considering a detail before give the verdict. Yes, I have a unique experience when I examine Imam Samudra. This is he's the mastermind of Bali Blast. He has the strength of ideology, and since the investigation, he does not want to be investigated by police woman. He said that in his religion, being in one room or have the eye contact with a woman, there is not relative or families in is prohibited. But fortunately, the examination runs smoothly, and the suspect answered my question, even though he did not look at my eyes. And finally, based on the proof and the judge's evaluation, he is punished with death penalty. This is I can give you the number, because after the Bali bomb blast, Indonesia still have the many bomb terror attacks, and until 2005, last year, we get 207 cases of terrorism, and mostly 50%, almost 60% has been punished. And this the last year, the Indonesian police has successfully catch and also kill the mastermind of the Bali and of the terror attack Indonesia. It's called Dr. Asahari. He is the expert in the bomb, and also a group of them is already examined in the court. There's a my conclusion of the my what my experience in the judicate of terror bomb. For the next explanation, my explanation, you can follow my essay, and that will be published by NSLS. Thank you.
Now we're going to open it up to questions, but as is the privilege of the moderator, I get to ask the first question. And I want to set it up because it's a personal question and one which I'm very interested in the answer. To the extent that any society, believes in the rule of law, commits itself to the rule of law, as opposed to the will of whoever happens to be in power, that society necessarily has people who are going to serve in the judicial office. Those judicial officers necessarily are a branch or a part of the government of the society. But whatever the culture, whatever the society, adherence to the rule of law requires, it's the very woof and fabric of the guild, if you will, that those individuals be independent. Independent of the government of which they are a part. So that the rule of law can be evenly and fairly applied. So that's one principle, and I want to pause for just a moment, and you can see why I am humbly proud to be, and I am, most sincerely, a part of this panel, because assembled here are two of the finest judges you're ever going to see, judges who have actually been in these most excruciatingly difficult cases. And so I wonder if I couldn't just ask you for a round of applause for the judges that we have. Okay, now that's fine. We're talking about terrorism cases. And Dr. Ansari served it up properly. At the beginning, the primary function of the state is the security of its citizens. I recently had occasion for a law review article I'm writing to look at Hamdi versus Rumsfeld. And though I'm characterizing it, the majority says this: the right to wage war includes the powers to win the war. There it is. Now, those principles are difficult to harmonize. Now I'll stop and simply ask my question, and then really we want your most difficult questions. Here's my personal question. We're going to go in reverse order, so I'll start with Judge Sadoui. The judges here all sit on courts of more general jurisdiction than terrorist cases. Their profession is judging in a variety of circumstances. They have had excruciatingly difficult terrorist cases. My question is simply this. When you're doing one of these cases, what's different? How do you personally feel differently to in handling such a case? Judge Sadoui. If at all.
I feel more special in handling cases of terrorism. Because the case itself has terrorized me. And the world's attention is focusing on me. So I have more responsibility in handling the terrorism case than ordinary case.
Thank you. Justice Wetherill, same question.
I want to return to context. My colleagues and I try cases which are a form of domestic terrorism. That means that those who are the terrorists come from the community of which we are a part. They are not flying the Atlantic and crashing into our buildings. They live next door to us. Therefore, when we are trying these cases, we must remember, we try to remember, that this is part of our own society that has engaged in this activity. And we try to address that because what we are doing is part of the resolution of the conflict of which we are also part. So I hope I see it in the context, and I try to remember that context when I'm trying these offenses.
Thank you. Dr. Ansari, you've studied this worldwide. From your scholar's perspective, as an attorney and jurist, do judges act differently?
I believe they are, but my concern is not about judges. My concern is about the growing administrative powers in the criminal justice system. For example, you have the Republic of Ireland have the Special Criminal Court. You have the Director of Public Prosecution, the one who decides what to be certified in and what to be certified out. What goes to the Special Criminal Court and what should not be in the Special Criminal Court. This kind of administrative power trouble me a lot, and I believe that, like what Judge Wetherup said, that in 2007, I hope that the Northern Ireland Dublin Court will be abolished, and we will go to a growing applying of the normal criminal justice act in Northern Ireland, where the judges who decide what to go to a special criminal court or what they call it a non-jury trial and what is not, and not the administrator.
Thank you. The power of prosecution is always a crucial power. All right, you can address your question to an individual panelist or the panel. Start with Kelly.
I want to thank all y'all for coming. I have a question for basically all of the panelists. And Judge Young, if you want to weigh in on this. With the Northern Ireland Court and the Anti-Terrorism Act and how that affects the court in Indonesia, both of those are still criminal courts as we normally understand them, and they are run by the independent judiciary. And my question is, in America, we have no such special court for terrorism. There have been a couple proposals that would create one, but nothing has come of it yet. And so the actions have been taken to move the implementations to military tribunals. Neither of your systems involve the military. And doing so brings up the distinction of whether or not they are to be considered, you know, soldiers or criminals. And, you know, is this a war, is this a criminal act, and all of those issues that come up. What do y'all think, from your perspective, are the long-reaching implications of involving the military in the court that are adjudicating the same type of cases that your court system do? And in the end, do you think that will be effective, or do you think that...
I taught you short questions, if you'll recall. Short questions when you're interrogating. You'll recall that from evidence. Thank you very much. All right. What's the involvement, how do you feel about the involvement of the military? And we'll start with Justice Wetherill.
Well, I would ask, what is the purpose of engaging the military in the process? You are dispensing with those who are trained to conduct trials, and presumably you do not consider them to be appropriate to hear particular cases if you substitute for them a military tribunal. And why are you deciding to do so? It may be for security reasons, but there must be systems to provide protection for the judges, as we have in Northern Ireland. If it is to do with vetting of material and public interest issues like that, we face those issues because all material, even if there is a public interest element in it, comes before the judges. The judges might decide whether public interest material gets into a trial. When we do these Diploc trials, we have a disclosure judge who's not the trial judge. The disclosure judge, as a judge would vet for jury material, the disclosure judge vets material that might come to the trial judge. So I would just leave it on the basis of a question back, which is, why is it considered necessary to introduce a military tribunal?
Judge Sadoui, the involvement of the Indonesian military in your processes, how do you feel? What's the extent?
We have a completely different system to decide which one is to determine as a military case and which one which aren't military. General court. So by involving military to the general court, it would be against the law. So according to me, we have to differentiate between a military action and general case.
And I take it in the cases of the bombings in Bali, the society determined that this would be treated in the usual criminal courts. Who made that determination? The Parliament made the determination. By special act or under the existing laws of Indonesia? Thank you. Dr. Ansari, you spoke about the involvement of the military together with the general courts, at least in Turkey and France, if I was following. How has that worked? You said that there was a challenge under the European community to that. Maybe you could reflect on it for us.
I talked about that earlier, and I said the problem is the is the impartiality or independency of the judges. What matter actually is not the judges themselves as military judges, but the judges who is actually subject to administrative procedure. Judges were actually being removed by the administrative, were being actually appointed by the administrative. So they feel the pressure by the administrative to apply certain judgment. Let me go beyond that, and I say for your question, I believe that justice will be served better if we try first cases in the ordinary criminal justice system and not the military courts. We spoke on that, Judge Young, and I believe that the American federal court has a successful, statistics, if we can say, or of trying terrorist cases, 100% conviction, and it worked within the ordinary criminal justice system, so we don't need to establish a special courts or military court. The idea of establishing the military tribunal all before now the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will judge on that. But beyond that, I believe that justice will be better served if we let the criminal justice system, the ordinary one, handle first cases instead of creating two trial systems within one country.
Thank you. Sir. Your question. Well, we'll ask Dr. Ansari to start. He's studied our courts as well as those of other nations.
Well, actually, I wasn't actually familiar with that court system, but my concern is in the fewer application of suspect rights. For example, the suspect under the military commission does not have the right for appeal, am I correct? And they have the right.
Yeah,
okay, maybe it's a change here. But instead of comparing between the military, regular criminal court, military courts, and the military or the military tribunals, we can say that suspects in military courts enjoy more rights than the military commission. I talked with Professor John Milton Moore, and he's in the view of he's the head of the National Security Center in Charlottesville University of Virginia, and he actually in the view of instead of creating special courts and military tribunals, why we just try these terrorists in the regular military courts instead of doing that, or instead of that creating a temporary special court under Article 3, for example, Constitution, to try terrorist cases if we found out that there is a reason for establishing such courts, for example, the same reasons that the Northern Ireland Court has been established because of jurors' intimidation or witnesses' intimidation. But the same, you cannot actually apply the same criteria for in cases involved, terrorist cases in the United States. So my comment is that I'm a strong believer of the criminal, ordinary criminal justice, and I believe that terrorist cases should be tried there, and we have a successful record of trying these cases before federal courts instead of creating special courts.
You asked about our own system, and I think there's one thing that I would say, and it's this. The United States has and has had for some years a proud tradition of legal professionalism in its judge advocate service, whatever the branch of service. Attorneys in our judge advocates programs are well prepared. They are highly ethical. They are devoted to their clients. And although within the military system, I shouldn't even say although within the military system, but that must be recognized, it's a hierarchical military system, they are independent of judgment. Now that said, the fundamental policy question seems to be the question that Justice Weatherup has propounded. Why? And as to that question, I duck, for the simple reason that as a sitting judge, I may have to face it. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Kunisa Baranashi, an Indonesian student at American University. And my question is addressed to Justice Kennedy. I understand that terrorism in Indonesia is a sensitive issue, particularly that it involves the religious world, especially that 80%, more than 80% of the Asian population are Muslim. My question is, how do, what is the interaction between the religious side, particularly often from the British, other terrorist suspects in the city, the interaction between that and the legal aspect, and whether religion becomes a hindrance, perhaps, to the legal proceedings?
The interaction of religion with the legal processes. Judge Zeewee.
We're not only focused only to the religion. But we are focusing on the criminal action he does. So religion is one of the background. One of the background of his action. And religion in this case is the goal of his action. But at the end, we're focusing on the criminal action of what he does instead of the religion itself.
Could I follow up and ask, suppose the offender claims his religious faith as the motivating reason for the act that the state has declared is a terrorist act. Would he be punished less severely, more severely, or the same?
No.
He'd be the same. He'd be punished the same in light of the law of Indonesia and the act of which he was convicted.
Yes.
All right? I see no...
Sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes, go ahead.
Accept. Except if he if he break the rules of that religion itself, then he would have more sanctions to that.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
My question is, two very brief questions, one for Judge Weatherup. The case you mentioned about that you convicted a defendant on the reasonable the possession of an article giving reasonable suspicion to believe that it could be used for terrorist activity. I was wondering what the sentence was for that individual. And my second question is for all the judges, particularly Chief Judge Young, if you are not constrained from answering it. Do you believe in our current climate and our the military tribunals, the Hamdi case, the Padilla case, that the United States is in fact following the rule of law in the war on terror?
First, Judge Weatherup.
6 years. My sentencing remarks were longer. The maximum penalty is 10 years imprisonment. He did contest that we have a system of discount for pleas, which works out broadly at a third if you're going to plead, and the circumstances are taken into account. He had been arrested as an illegal immigrant, and in investigating him as an illegal immigrant, they found that he had four or five aliases, and this led to a trail through the Republic where he had been, for the Republic of Ireland where he had been, and Holland, and his origins in Africa. So all of that had been investigated, but he had been in custody for 8 months before he'd been arrested in respect of these charges, while investigations were going on and his many passports were being examined. So allowance was made that he had spent 8 months in custody. Then you get credit, of course, for the period you've been from charge to sentence. So the 6 years would have run from an earlier period than the sentence was imposed, which was about a year before.
I'll actually try to answer your question, but I think, you be the judge. The answer in large measure is going to be affected by your concept of law. One of the fascinating things we are seeing in our polity in the United States today is a careful reexamination of the role of each of the three branches of our government in determining what is constitutional. So I tell a brief story and leave it at that. There was a Baltimore Clipper by the name of Amy Warwick. The Amy Warwick, not knowing that Fort Sumter had been fired on, was bound for Baltimore with a load of coffee from Brazil. She was encountered by a converted New York ferry boat named the Quaker City, and held forfeit for running President Lincoln's blockade. A war power, Congress not in session. She was sent to Boston to be condemned for running the blockade. Of course, they were saying, what blockade? What's going on here? They were prosecuted by Richard Henry Dana, wrote 2 years before the mast, came before my predecessor, Felix Sprague, and he said, Lincoln has the power as president to exercise war powers, even against our own citizens, because the exigencies of the situation require it. Affirmed, said the Supreme Court in the prize cases, from that time until today, cited as the authority for the president to make instantaneous war as he is commander-in-chief, cited in the bombing of Cambodia, for example. All right. I have that in mind because when the outcry came up about that, the Justice Department sent one of its top lawyers to explain things to the Bar Association of the City of New York, a very powerful Bar Association. That lawyer, William Rehnquist. All right. The short of it is this. Each branch gets to analyze the Constitution itself. It's not just the judiciary that's the holder of the ring under our constitutional system of government. That very fact confers enormous power on the people because we can come to specific cases, but I'll stay away from specific cases. Who's going to indict? Will it come before a jury? What will the jury do? Will a judge enjoin? If enjoined, what power does the person in another branch of government? One can hardly conceive of enjoining the president, but you can enjoin people below the president. With that general, what do you see? Ultimately, we will work out, as we have over the 200 years of our existence, how it all works. Your question, a wonderful question, assumes that we know what the law is. I start almost every case, and the fellow starts talking about 6B. I'm saying, okay, what's the law here? I can assure you this, within the judicial branch of government, we are striving with heart and soul and mind to follow the law. Sir.
Let me begin by saying that the special criminal courts or national security courts provide a good example of the difference between the ordinary criminal justice system and the special measures that has been adopted by the government to protect its interests. For example, in European countries, judges actually go by or apply a minimum standard of human rights, or the European Convention of Human Rights is the actually major act or convention that the European court, the European judges apply. And when this within the European Convention, there is a set of rules for judges to follow, and for any act to be reviewed by. For example, let me give you this an example for extended police custody. Many countries applied for terrorist cases extended police custody sometime, as in Turkey, to 30 days. It was that way up to 1999. And for example, United Kingdom up to 1984, it was for 5 days without going, without actually being brought promptly before a judge. The European Convention or the European Court of Human Rights held that this is a violation of the convention because they actually, within the developing of the cases within the court, they usually decided that this is excessive, what they call period of police custody without being actually brought promptly before a judge. So it depends on the jurisdiction and what applied in the ordinary criminal justice system within jurisdiction. You have, for example, in France, this the Special Aziz Court, for example, I'm sorry, criminal justice system or the criminal procedure apply a special procedure for terrorist cases where the police custody in France can go up to 72 hours without being brought before a judge. This kind, it's less in different countries, but comparing this to what is applied for ordinary suspects in ordinary criminal cases, that's a special measure. Well, can we say that this is will violate the European Convention of Human Rights? No, it's within the limits of the European Convention of Human Rights. But the basic idea of having two trial systems is what concerns human rights organizations of applying another or special measures for terrorist cases and apply other ordinary measures for ordinary system. So my answer is it's different from between country to country. But what is matter is to judge how excessive these kind of measures and how it violates basically the civil rights of the country.
I've got to keep this on track. A quick answer about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. From the outside now, I think it works and works well. I think it is wrong to say it's co-opted because it uniformly or almost uniformly issues the summonses that the executive wants or the search warrants the executive wants. And my reason for saying that is I've been a United States District Judge in the most independent branch of the judiciary for 21 years. I issue search warrants routinely. I have narrowed some. I have demanded more information on some. Thinking of your question, I have refused one in 21 years. It appears that we are about as independent a judiciary as exists in the world. Quick question. Yes, Justice Weatherup, I'm sorry. Maybe we're not the most independent. We'll let him go ahead.
Dr. Farrell's comment about the extended detention, I think that's a good question about the rise of independence of the judiciary and overseeing investigations. I think that one must understand that what the judges are doing in these cases is not becoming involved in the investigation. It is an oversight role. And certain conditions must be satisfied, and on satisfaction then the judge might authorize a period of extended detention. But in the UK generally, this is not something that applies to terrorist cases, this is something that applies to all arrested persons. They can apply to a court, the police can apply to a court, in order to get a warrant for extended detention. The difference in terrorist cases is that you can apply for longer periods. There is a prospect of a 7-day detention. as the maximum. Now, when the court held, as it did, that 4 days is too long in one case, that was because authorization for a court beyond 4 days was given by an executive order, not by a judicial order. And when they changed that later to introduce the judge as the party whose decision would justify extended detention, it ceased to be contrary to the European Convention, as is the present position. So judicial supervision became the form of regulation of what might otherwise have been a breach.
One last quick question, quick answer, because you need the break. Is terrorism a crime against humanity, and if so, how will it be tried? Judge Sidhu.
For the crime against humanity, we have to establish the law of on our national act. So, as just mentioned that, for example, for the limitation of detention, for detention.
In the case of detention, illegal detention is very sensitive in our country. And it is an issue of human rights. So in my country, human rights issue is an international issue. It's considered as national issue. Which we already have our own rules regarding this matter.
Thank you. And would you all please thank the panel. 15-minute recess.